Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm your host, Rakshit Shetty, a research analyst at Takshashila Institution, and today we delve into a crucial topic. Is Bangladesh embarking on a new journey? Joining us for this discussion is Dr. Sriradha Datta. Dr. Datta is a professor of international affairs at the O.P. Jindal Global University. She's also a non-resident senior fellow with the Institute of South Asian Studies, National University of Singapore. She has written multiple books, including her recent work, Bangladesh on a New Journey, India-Bangladesh Bond Homi, 1971 and the Present, ACT East Policy and Northeast Asia, BIMSTEC, The Journey and the Way Ahead, and Bangladesh at 50, Development and Challenges. And I'm pretty sure I'm still missing a few of her books. She also published over 160 journal articles, edited volumes, newspapers, and academic websites. Her research interests include South Asia and Southeast Asia, regionalism, and cross-border issues. Rest assured, we bring you the authority on Bangladesh studies in India for this discussion. So grab a cup of coffee, settle in, and enjoy this podcast. Welcome, Dr. Datta. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Rakshit. I enjoyed the flattering introduction.
Right. So just to lay the context, Bangladesh is now something of a global development poster child. Born out of war more than 50 years ago, it has hauled itself out of poverty to become one of the fastest growing economies in the Asia-Pacific region. But the nation still faces many challenges. Climate change threatens to overwhelm its low-lying lands. Corruption is endemic, and many critics complain that democracy and freedom of speech are under pressure. Dr. Datta, could you give us a brief overview of the historical relationship between India and Bangladesh? How is India's role in the 1971 war perceived in Bangladesh? And was there a concern at that time that India might not leave Bangladesh after liberating it?
Yes, Rakshit, there was for a longest period of time fear about India's intention, India's motive, what India was going to do. But I think the history of wars, it's never been known for a country to leave it so early, which India did, within weeks of the war being completed. But I think while during Mujibur Rahman, who enjoyed a very close relationship with India's Prime Minister Indira Gandhi at that point of time, things were certainly very positive, upbeat. We were able to sign a large framework of cooperation agreement. So everything was going more or less okay at that point of time till 1975, which was, you know, the unfortunate assassination of Mujibur Rahman, Bangabandhu, as he's popularly known. And that really changed everything. Military regimes came in place. There were coups, counter coups, whole long phases of political instability in some ways. But from 75 onwards to 1990, we've had two phases of military rule at that point of time. And that was when clearly India and Bangladesh were certainly talking to each other, but missed the kind of warmth and friendship that they had enjoyed during the post-71 phase. And it was at that point of time that there was a very definite reconstruction of history that was taking place in Bangladesh, and no, absolutely no mention of India, India's role in the liberation war. And in fact, for years together, I think the first official recognition I recall is actually during the 2006-2007 period, when there was a caretaker government in place. And that was the first time there was an official recognition in those last many years. And then subsequently, of course, kind of a very, very breakthrough happened in 2009 elections, with Sheikh Hasina taking over with a very, very overwhelming victory, electoral victory that she had. And India-Bangladesh relationship really transformed from that time onwards. And of course, there was now, in terms of liberation war specifically, when Bangladesh became 50 years, India and Bangladesh had a lot of joint programs. So there was a celebration not only within Bangladesh, but we were also celebrating both our bilateral ties with Bangladesh as well as the liberation war. And many such, you know, films were planned, many other museum activities were planned, whole lot of joint programs which is again, I think, unprecedented between any nation's neighbors, especially in the region. So that was, of course, a complete, as I said, the breakthrough happened at that point of time.
Thank you, Dr. Datta. And you also mentioned about the caretaker democracy in the late 90s and early 2000s. And many of our listeners might not be familiar with the concept of a caretaker democracy and its role in Bangladesh. Could you help us understand what a caretaker democracy is and why it has been necessary in Bangladesh's political landscape and how many caretaker governments have been in place in Bangladesh?
So, as I mentioned, that after Mujibur Rahman's assassination, military red government by Ziaur Rahman took over. He was assassinated, and then Eshad took over, who was there for the longest period till 1990. He stepped down. So, it was in 1991 that we find a return of multi-party democracy, and this was, of course, a very again a very unprecedented with all political parties coming together to oust the military leader, and who, of course, at that point of time was ruling through his Jatiya party that he had established. Like Ziaur Rahman had established BNP, which is Bangladesh Nationalist Party, and Eshad, the next leader, military leader, had established Jatiya party. So all the political parties at that point of time, which is essentially Awami League and BNP and also other smaller parties, including the civil society, were all out on the streets demanding Eshad's resignation, which it finally happened. But when the multi-party system, was brought back, again, the political parties were very, very insecure about themselves, apprehensive what the other one would do. So they didn't trust the electoral process under that particular government. So it was actually at the behest and demand of Awami League in 1996 that they introduced caretaker government, who essentially is interim government for 3 months, headed by a caretaker advisor and led 10 technocrats a part of this government, whose entire task entrusted on them is to ensure free and fair election. So they support the election commission to oversee elections. That is exactly what it was meant for. So finally, it was actually brought in through a constitutional amendment. And so from 96 onwards, we've had every time there was an election, a caretaker government was there 3 months ahead and who would then oversee elections. In 2006, when BNP was finishing in Turp in 2006, October, it tried to manipulate the system. And to such an extent that it was, there are some technical rules as to who can be a chief advisor and who can be the technocrats. They tried to manipulate the system, which again got in a kind of a standstill in Bangladeshi politics at that point of time. So from 2006 October to 2008 December, this caretaker government, which also many have pointed to the fact that there was basically an army who was leading from behind, backing this particular government, who ran the polity at that point of time. And they actually were able to address many of the anomalies that were seen during 2006 when the country was heading towards electoral polls, which included a voters list. So they had a very faulty voters list. Awami League had pointed out that BNP's voters list basically missed a certain significant percentage of Awami voters, and a whole lot of other problems were there, which was addressed by this particular caretaker government. But subsequently, when Sheikh Hasina took over in 2009, January, one of the first things she did was overturn this amendment. She brought in many other amendments and positive changes for bringing in a more secular fabric for Bangladesh, which had been earlier overturned by the military leaders. But that apart, she excluded the caretaker government from the constitution. And subsequently, from there onwards, we see issues within the Bangladesh polity as of now. There has been a demand by the opposition for a return of the caretaker government. But the Awami League says that no, they have been constitutionally amended and they're out of the system. They cannot be brought in because now they feel that they're a strong and mature enough political system where, like in India and like anywhere else, that election commission or other organs of a political nation can hold elections as an independent measure, which is something that the opposition continues to argue with. And they, as you know, in the last election, which was just a few months ago in January this year, the opposition was unable to attend, did not join the elections on. There were several points that they had, but demand for caretaker was one of that. But essentially, while that particular phase I mentioned where caretaker government stayed on much longer than as has been mandated, Otherwise, caretaker government till then had done a very clean and effective job of ensuring free and fair polls.
Talking about the free and fair polls, Dr. Nitha, the Corruption Perception Index ranks Bangladesh among the bottom 10 countries. How serious do you think the corruption problem is within Bangladesh and the institutions like the Election Commission Department that we just talked about? And is this a new trajectory that Bangladesh is going on? I mean, is this a new journey of Bangladesh we are talking about? Where is it going from here on?
Unfortunately, while Bangladesh has achieved many economic milestones in this last 50 plus years, on the corruption index, it's never done very well. It had picked up a few notches in between, but it's also had another slide in the last few years. That is also why I maintain that, you know, the different organs of the government have kind of been taken over. There's a huge overreach of the executive. So clearly they are not functioning independently as they should in a parliamentary democracy. But more importantly, there are many other issues of corruption there. I mean, in recent times, the media, both Bangladesh and international media, has brought to the public domain about the kind of fraudulent schemes and scams that has taken place in the banking sector. There are huge issues within the financial structure of Bangladesh. Bangladesh, which had recorded a 6% plus growth rate for most of these last 50 years, despite extreme political upheaval, as you mentioned, their vulnerability to climate change issues and other problems that they face. But right now, they're actually going down. And I think the latest World Bank report says they'll be somewhere in the tune of 5.1% growth rate, which is huge come down from what it was recording in the past. But again, as we see, it's not only just, I mean, there were many cases, as I mentioned, of banks. But even otherwise, there was the other day a report by one of the media houses about how there are about a significant percentage of MPs who are part of these scams, who are known to be corrupt, where they have been revealed in terms of the assets and all of that. So clearly, there are many issues. And another factor being that while Bangladesh has changed from a fund-receiving country to now, as you know, it was able to also support Sri Lankan Sound Ways by giving them some funds. But in terms of FDI, it hasn't done well at all. While its other indexes are very good, and some of, you know, the economists and people who political analysts attribute to the fact that the image of Bangladesh as a corrupt country, as a country where it's very difficult to do business without greasing palms, is something which is has deterred international investment to come into Bangladesh. So corruption is clearly a problem that the polity is facing.
Thank you so much for that. So moving on to global events, how serious is looking at the Maldives-India relationship and how Moise government's anti-India or India Out campaign turned out the bilateral relationship. How serious do you think the India Out campaign by the BNP party in Bangladesh going to work out? And do you think India-Bangladesh relations are structurally ingrained to get affected, or is it contingent upon the current regime in Bangladesh?
The Indian Out campaign, I think, is an extremely unsustainable campaign. It's not going to work because the kind of interdependence that India and Bangladesh has economically with each other in every which way, socially, politically, it's difficult to sustain that campaign. But what I feel is that BNP here, again, BNP, I think, has confined itself to the, you know, margins of political participation by not being part of the electoral scene landscape for the last three terms. For whatever reason, they may say that their demands were not met and there are other issues, yes. But I feel BNP let down its own electoral support by, you know, by participating in the elections. But this particular campaign is more of a, I would think it's a issue that they have with Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina and with governance issues. There are civil governance issues within Bangladesh at this point of time. And I think the angst of, and this is basically, as you know, this campaign is mainly been seen in the social media. There has been no other platform where we've seen such a campaign being raised or being discussed. It's basically the new social media which is the domain of the youngsters, as you very well know. And this is, I feel, anger about Sheikh Hasina, about the way she's run this election, the way she's running her government. It's reflecting on everything that goes wrong with Sheikh Hasina or Bangladesh at this point of time, there's an invariably kind of a spiral effect on India. Everybody feels that it's because of India's support that Bangladesh is able to, you know, go ahead with whatever it's doing, but they think is hasn't been the correct way forward. So, but while I think the campaign will not sustain, because as I said, the dependency is just way too much. And if they do really want to sustain that, they're going to cut themselves and, you know, they're going to bleed very deeply if that happens. I think the adverse effect of India out campaign is going to be felt by them and not by India, really. So that is something, but it's, I think this campaign is about a messaging. And I think that messaging is something that both Bangladesh by itself, the government needs to address, needs to, you know, consider. And of course, it's something that I'm not sure how much India is really concerned at this point of time, because we all understand that in terms of goods and in terms of, you know, the issues that they are raising, the kind of dependency, I mean, it's a cross dependency really, that it doesn't really make much sense, but they're making the noises. And again, we feel it's going to be just confined to the social media and not go to any other mature or politically correct platforms.
So much hate for Sheikh Hasina within the country. But I'm really impressed by how she maintained good relations with both India and China. I mean, could you please shed some light on how she navigates these relationships with India and China without causing bitterness on either side?
I think that's absolutely. In fact, the book that you referred to about Bangladesh and a new journey, and you asked whether Bangladesh, that new journey is about corruption. I forgot to mention that the new journey is not about corruption. The new journey is really upbeat, idea about where Bangladesh is going. And I feel that Bangladesh for very long was confined to being a, you know, a small South Asian entity. I think Bangladesh has now been able to kind of pull its weight largely in the entire global space, and especially the way the geopolitics is now far more focused on Bay of Bengal and Indo-Pacific. So Bangladesh has a far more, I would say, critical importance to many of the players in that region. And Sheikh Hasina, I would say, has certainly done a wonderful job. And it's true for all of Bangladesh, all these phases, despite the different political leaders, despite their own political differences. I think all the leaders of Bangladesh have very sincerely followed a foreign policy doctrine that was laid down by Mujibur Rahman, which was a friendship with all and enmity with none. That's the policy that they have constantly, you know, fallen back on. And I think they've been able to have very close engagement with powers, not only within the region, but even outside and larger external players. Coming to India and China, I think it's a completely different from what we see our other neighbors doing. They, as you rightly mentioned, Bangladesh or Dhaka does not play China against India or India against China. They, I think, has, especially Sheikh Hasina, has conveyed to India extremely sincerely about how important India is to Bangladesh. And we've seen from 2010 onwards the kind of engagement that India and Bangladesh share is unprecedented, the kind of bilateral partnership that we have now been able to establish. We are also doing working with Japan in Bangladesh, another trilateral friendship partnerships emerging. So a lot of new things that we are working together on. With China also, China has been, ever since China recognized Bangladesh, which is after Mujibur Rahman, they, from defense partnership to political infrastructure partnership, Bangladesh and China have worked very closely. And for the longest period of time, and Bangladesh has, through the years, irrespective of its friendship with India or USA or any other player, it has been able to consistently engage with China. Much of Bangladesh's larger infrastructure projects has been funded by China, has been supported by China. And unlike some of the other South Asian countries that you mentioned, which is Sri Lanka, Maldives, similarly, I think Nepal is probably walking that little difficult path. Bangladesh has not fallen into a debt crisis. They had the balance of payment problem Bangladesh is facing just now. There's a foreign reserve problem Bangladesh is facing just now. But this is not necessarily because of its own engagement or its development partnership with China. So it has, I think, extremely well navigated that space, works, has conveyed the right things about China to China also. So China and Bangladesh continue to engage more deeply on many of the joint projects that they're doing, and those projects have been multiplying. And with India, as I said, from 2010 onwards, we have been able to attain and examine many other aspects of the relationship, which was completely ignored earlier.
Professor, I mean, the entire Indo-Pacific region means different to different actors. Right? I mean, it's much of a maritime issue for the US. It's a little bit of territorial issue for India. My question is, how does Bangladesh view the Indo-Pacific region in terms of its strategic interests and alliance? Does its vision go beyond Bay of Bengal to Indo-Pacific, or does it really care about Indo-Pacific, or does it not?
Bangladesh, 2023, actually, published an Indo-Pacific outlook. So quite clearly putting themselves out there. And I think, as you rightly mentioned, and I say the same thing, that Bay of Bengal is core to Bangladesh. I mean, they really straddle South Asia and Southeast Asia, sitting at the cusp of Bay of Bengal. But while that is, of course, completely inherent and part of their territorial waters, but Indo-Pacific is something that they would also want to stake a claim on in terms of the larger interplay of actors that we see. And I think in this global world where there's a kind of a multipolarity which is emerging, there are many polarities that we are discussing, Bangladesh has staked its claim. And I think Indo-Pacific is also one such geographical strategic sphere where they don't want to be left out, and they very much, the fact that they call it an outlook and not anything else also gives them a leeway to work even without players who are not part of the Indo-Pacific. So, you know, they've also tried to kind of assure China about their intention. At the same time, they've been also, as we are all aware of the fact that the Quad players are also happy to have more such strong players in the region join the Indo-Pacific strategic space. And I think Bangladesh is able to do exactly that, while manage its relationship with the other players who are not part of the Indo-Pacific, but also quite positively send a message across that they would certainly want to be part of the Indo-Pacific and whatever it means in terms of its strategic and political engagement.
Lastly, Dr. Datta, India and the US perceive Bangladesh differently. I mean, their interests are completely different. Do you believe that India's relationship with Bangladesh have any impact on its relationship with the United States and the Western countries in general?
You know, for the longest time, having watched South Asia closely, I often would feel that US and India's interests, by and large, converge in South Asia, in the sense that, you know, US is very far away. It doesn't have any, you know, aggressive posturing in South Asia per se. And it has always supported the democratic space. It's also supported multi-party elections. It supported basically India's engagement in the region. I think that's something I always thought was, I mean, both of them were on the same platform vis-a-vis South Asia. And I also largely felt that the US was very comfortable with the way India was engaging and didn't kind of, there was no skepticism about that, while there was a lot of apprehensions vis-a-vis what China was doing in South Asia. But during the election and run up to the election, we saw, like I said, it was a very one-party, one-sided election. And Bangladesh government used every tool possible, every machinery that they had to kind of ensure that the opposition was left out and kept on the margins. They stifled any voice which is not pro-government. There were many such issues. And on all of that, US, I think, pointed that out. And in between, as you know, just before elections a year ago and a half, they had brought in sanctions against some officers of the Rapid Action Battalion Force, a force who was responsible for many of the counter-terror measures that Bangladesh had implemented, and very strongly so, in the past. But subsequently, US had threatened Bangladesh with more sanctions if they saw that electoral polls were not multi-party and they were not, you know, participative by nature and certainly free and fair. But we saw what happened. It largely became a Awami versus Awami kind of a one-sided elections, and Awami Day came in. The opposition is also led by Awami. So it's a kind of a weird situation there. But Sunday we did see, and after making a lot of noises by both the ambassador sitting in Dhaka as well as, the State Department, there has been a lot, almost a deafening silence, I would see. I think US now seems too preoccupied with its own electoral landscape. There are other issues that it's handling. We know about the war which they've been embroiled with. So this particular issue has now been completely, there has been no update on that. And I think India, of course, as we know, we are always wanting a stable neighborhood, a peaceful neighborhood. And with Sheikh Hasina leading Bangladesh, we've certainly been able to have a very, both a stable stability as well as a peaceful engagement. So that's not something that we would like to change. And that was one particular point of, I would say, dissent at that point of time. But now, if you ask me post the elections, it looks as it's business as usual. So while, and I think India-US relations are far robust, far comprehensive, to be upset by one particular aspect. This is just one particular vertical in the many other verticals that US and India share. And I think there was a bit of a difference of opinion about what they considered free and fair multi-party democratic elections and what India considered multi-party democratic elections. But that apart, I think it now, I don't see anybody revisiting that particular aspect in the near future. But on other aspects, I don't think it's affected Indo-US, and which I think, again, both Indo-US has also reached a stage which is very deep, far more robust than it ever has been in the past. So that is not going to be upset by, you know, incident or one particular neighbor that we don't necessarily agree on. We certainly don't agree on the way they support Pakistan and, you know, many other issues surrounding Afghanistan and Pakistan. But as I said, those are some aspects of the relationship, but largely Indo-US relationship is going to be stronger and deeper in the years to come.
Right. I mean, I'm done with the questions. I mean, I've not had the chance to read your book yet, but I know there are 13 chapters. And I mean, when I'm compared to your other books, I see this book as much more comprehensive, with even climate change being the topic in the book, right? So would you like to have the last comments on your book and what it is about mostly?
I'm not happy to be told that this is the more comprehensive than others, but never mind. I'll overlook that. No, this,
I mean, the context of the themes covered in the book, right?
Yeah, so let me just say that I had done a couple of years ago a book under the same Singapore ISAS, on Bangladesh at 50, which was basically a celebration of the journey. And as I mentioned, that the 50 years was many milestones and many benchmarks that they've achieved. From a country, as you mentioned, was poverty-ridden, didn't have adequate food supply for its own population, but now it's 18% of its GDP is contributed through its agro sector exports. So it's certainly come a long way. So while that book was about the domestic transformation, I realized that there was another transformation taking place, which is at the foreign policy level. And we were not paying enough attention to it. So this book is actually about the transformation that, of course, is supported by the fact that Bangladesh's economic growth and journey, which has taken the world, you know, it's kind of captivated the imagination of the world, and the kind of social indexes that it was able to achieve. It had better HDI than many of other neighbors in South Asia, including India. It had many other milestones. It was, in fact, graduating from a low-income country. It was graduating from the LDC in 2026. So many other achievements that were happening alongside the fact that Bangladesh was able to also engage with some very, very, you know, big partners. India, China, of course, is a case in point, and both extremely big neighbors that they've been able to straddle very well and, you know, engage robustly without much friction. I mean, any political international relation there is bound to be ups and downs, but largely it's been a positive story. But what this book is examining actually as how US is looking at and how the whole world, and you mentioned the US and the other Western economies, were really not interested in Bangladesh. And Bangladesh was only in the news for negative issues like terrorism or Islamic negative images. But this, from now, the way I see, everybody's looking at Bangladesh to a very positive. I mean, I say that Bangladesh is now like a force multiplier in their, you know, way of the whole multipolarity is emerging in the region. And every neighbor, whether it's Russia, if you look at the kind of cooperation that they have on their nuclear plant that they're building in Dhaka, the kind of collaboration they're now establishing with Germany, with France, of course, other Western, Bangladesh's largest export destination is, of course, the US and the EU. So a whole lot of international players are looking at Bangladesh through a completely different lens. And that is what I'm kind of focusing on when I say it's on a new journey. Earlier, the lens that one looked at Bangladesh was, you know, very singular. It was a typical small country, devastated, and all the challenges that it's in. But now they're looking at Bangladesh through a positive lens as to what it can do for that. It's not only about taking from other countries, what Bangladesh can deliver, can do, and work together to achieve a much more positive dividend for each other. That's a mutual journey that I'm talking about when I say that Bangladesh has embarked on a new journey. But of course, it has to maintain its whole economic, you know, indicators, so governance issue, transparency issues, those are, you know, also some of the other factors that are included in this journey. And I think if that can be, Bangladesh can reform, can revise the kind of slide down that it's seeing in the last 1 year, I'm sure there'll be a far more positive growth story about Bangladesh, not only economically, but in every aspect, including its foreign policy sphere.
Thank you so much, Dr. Datta. On that note, we'll end this podcast here. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and taking the time to be here with us. And to all our listeners, if you enjoyed this podcast, I'm pretty sure you would love her recent book titled Bangladesh on a New Journey, published by Bloomsbury, which is available across the globe. We'll have the Amazon link attached to the description below in the box. Thank you for tuning in. See you all in the next episode of All Things Policy.
Thanks, Akshit.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.